speeding bullets. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound.
Look, up in the sky. It's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's Superman.
Yes, it's Superman. Strange visitor from another planet who came to Earth with powers and abilities far beyond those of mortal men. Superman, who can change the course of mighty rivers, bend steel in his bare hands, and who, disguised as Clark Kent, mild-mannered reporter for a great metropolitan newspaper, fights a never-ending battle for truth, justice, and the American way. And now, another exciting episode in the adventures of Superman.
He's best known for his extraordinary powers of X-ray vision and strength and his sense of justice and righteousness, but Superman has evolved since his creation in the 1930s, often reflecting the changes in American culture, values, and norms. Larry Tye has written Superman, the High-Flying History of America's Most Endearing Hero, and joins us in studio this morning to talk about the book. Welcome.
Great to be here.
Boy, what a flashback listening to that. Brings me right back to those the old black and white TV sets that...
It was brilliant. George Reeves.
So you've written a number of biographies. So why did you decide to write a book about a mythical character?
So there were two reasons. The serious reason is I was intrigued by why America embraces the heroes that we do. And I decided, looking at the longest lived hero of the last century, Superman, who's about to turn next summer 75 years old. And in these days, when politicians last about 15 seconds, and when sports stars may last a season or two, the idea that somebody is still around after 75 years, I thought said a lot about them and at least as much about us.
Right.
But if that was a serious reason, the other more compelling reason was I wanted to be 10 again, and spending 2 years on this book made me feel that way.
Yeah, and Superman certainly evolved over the years, as we'll talk about. Superman was the creation of Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster in the 1930s. Tell us a bit more about how that mythical figure came to be.
Well, we now know, as part of the process of doing this book, I came across an unpublished 100-page memoir that Jerry Siegel wrote. And it basically portrayed him as a bullied kid, a kid who would go out to the playground every day when he was in grammar school, and kids would yell at him, "Seagull, seagull, birds of an eagle." Now, I'm not quite sure what that meant, but what it meant to him was major embarrassment, and he wished that he could fly away. And particularly wished that when the girls were listening to him being teased that way. And so since he couldn't fly, what he would do is every night he would go to bed with a pencil and a paper. And he would write down these stories that let him really be the superhero that he wanted to be. And the first character that he came up with was a guy named The Super-Man. And this was not a nice guy. He was a guy who could take over the world and who could basically fight back the way Jerry thought he should be able to fight back against the bullies. And that was the character we were left with until a very traumatic event happened when Jerry got to the end of his teenage years. And that traumatic event was one day his dad owned a haberdashery in a very poor part of Cleveland, Ohio. One day, three guys walked into the store, tried on a suit, and walked out without paying. And Jerry's dad started to go after them. He had a massive heart attack. He died on the spot. And suddenly Jerry Siegel, a Jewish Lithuanian son of refugees, the kid loses his dad and his mentor. And shortly after that, one night when he went to bed with his trademark pencil and paper, Superman dropped the he dropped the hyphen, and he dropped the bad guy act. And suddenly, we had in the first story that he wrote, and that the next morning his buddy Joe Shuster down the street drew, Superman was this guy who was swooping in to save a man who looked suspiciously like Michael Siegel, who was being robbed. Mm. So we see Superman as a little boy, bereft, coming back and inventing a hero that he very much needed.
Interesting, too, where we get our character names, you know, Lois. And these were all based on real people.
They were based on real people. Lois Lane, despite what Jerry told his wife and model in later years, Lois Lane was Lois Amster, a woman who now at age 96 is living in a nursing home in western Massachusetts. And she was the girl who sat on the other side of the room from Jerry during high school, who had no clue that he existed, but who he pined after. Mm. And years later, he got to make her a heroine.
So Jerry and Joe sold the rights to Superman to DC Comics for just $130. $5. Why so little?
Well, I call it the original sin of comic books. And it was so little because they were so desperate. They had been trying for 5 years to find somebody to publish their Superman story, and nobody would. And finally, when two ex-pornographers named Jack Liebowitz and Harry Donenfeld came along and offered Jerry the right to publish, basically, he would have taken nothing to do it. And the $130 has to be understood in context. This was not for the first 13-page story that they published in June of 1938. It was for the rights for Superman in perpetuity in comic books and comic strips, in radio and TV, in movies and everywhere.
Yeah, it's just such a crime. And we forget the 1930s and 40s, this is before television and start of radio. Comic books were the source of entertainment and not just for kids.
That is absolutely true. Kids may have read them under their under the bed covers at night with a flashlight, but their parents, when the kids tossed them away, their parents would pick them up and read them. And this was something that was read by everybody. It was also a way that they were teaching adults who were illiterate how to read. What better way could you do it? The pictures were right there. Mm-hmm. The words were all about five letters long. And it was the perfect way to get kids, whether they were starting out reading or adults who couldn't read, literate.
Yeah. Now, Superman's message and actions reflected the era and changed with the times. So describe the Superman of the 1940s versus the Superman of the 50s or 60s.
Sure. So we start out in the late 30s with Superman being exactly the kind of hero that not just Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster needed, but that America needed. We were mired in a depression, and we needed a butt-kicking New Deal liberal, and that was precisely what Joe and Jerry gave us. Superman in those days chased after wife beaters, after slumlords. He was the good guy lefty. In the 40s, we were going to war, and Superman helped take us to war. We needed a hero who, on the one hand, gave us a sense that we could take on anybody, and yet who didn't go to war himself. Had Superman gone to war, people would have wondered why he didn't win the war in 15 minutes. So they developed a brilliant guise. They had Clark Kent go in for his eye test when he wanted to enlist. And he used his X-ray vision not to read the chart in front of him, but to read the eye chart three examining rooms away. And he failed his eye test. So he ended up being there, protecting us on the home front. He was the one, when the government was trying to sell war bonds, they used Superman to sell war bonds. When they would send out these ration kits to troops overseas, every kit included candy, it included in those days cigarettes, and it included a comic book that almost always was a Superman comic book to remind the troops what they were going back to and the home front they were fighting for. In the 50s, when the menace seemed to be the Reds, Superman went out after the Red Menace. He chased down communists. Every era, he gave us the hero that we needed for that era, to the point where I like to say that Superman evolved more than the fruit fly did.
Talk a little bit about Superman. We get to the 70s and 80s. He continues to change. And there's a point where Superman does get married and kind of settles down and becomes less of our Superman, becomes more like us.
Well, he was in the 80s when Ronald Reagan was our hero. Superman cut his hair a bit. He toned down his politics and he became a whole lot more in line with the Reagan doctrine that seemed to be taking over America. But he also, over the years, he settled down at various points. He got married more times than anybody alive because it was, after all, fantasy. So we could have him married in one comic book and have him single again in the next one. But they tested out domesticity. Mm-hmm. And they had one of my favorite Superman covers ever was him flying off in his cape and Lois waving goodbye and saying, "Honey, I'll see you tonight at dinner." And this was, you know, every kid's fantasy was to see what would happen when Superman got into certain circumstances. So they killed him off. They brought him back to life. Mm-hmm. They married him off. They made him single again. They had him interested in Lois and then in Lana and then in a mermaid. I mean, it was just anything you wanted they could play with.
Yeah. And you have a, there's a picture in the book where Superman, he says he can't marry Lois or Lana because anybody who was not smart enough to see through his disguise was not smart enough to marry.
It was incredible. It was really interesting because they also at one point tried to come up with an excuse for why people were so dumb that they would accept his lousy disguise. And that excuse was that somehow the glasses that he put on when he transformed from Superman to Clark Kent had a hypnotic effect on anybody who looked at him. And I used to wonder, when I was a kid, I accepted everything in that great 1950s show that we started right. out with the, I accepted the idea that one of the worst actors alive, named George Reeves, transformed himself from Clark Kent to Superman, not by changing the register on his voice, not by changing anything other than taking off his glasses and his uniform. And yet, as a kid growing up in the 1950s, I wanted to believe, yeah. and so did, it seems like, everybody, every other kid.
Yeah, I was looking at the photos and just thinking, going, look at this man in these tights and this cape, and you think, how ridiculous. But we all fell for it.
We fell for it to the point that we didn't ask. When the bad guys were shooting at him, the bullets would bounce off of him. And yet when those crooks would get frustrated, they would toss the gun at him and he would duck. And that didn't seem inconsistent. We wanted to believe.
That's so funny. So how did Superman make that leap from radio into... Well, let's start with radio. First, the radio, we would go from the comic books to radio and then to TV. Talk about that leap from comic books to radio.
Sure. From comic books to radio, it was taking this notion of a character who had worked brilliantly in the comic book, selling millions of copies of every issue, and it was a real risk to go to radio. So they found a guy who didn't want the job to be Superman, and they thought they were going to have to hire two people, one who was going to play Clark and the other who was Superman. This guy, Bud Collier, who listeners may recognize from years later when he hosted a radio show and a TV show called To Tell the Truth, mm-hmm. he was Superman, and he was so good at changing his voice and really being convincing on the airwaves that the same guy was Clark and Superman, and he wanted to be a lawyer, he had trained to be a lawyer, and instead he became Superman, and he did it so successfully that it was thousands of radio shows. Then the question became, it was one thing going from comic books to radio, but what about when we actually had to look at and see this mm-hmm. Superman? And that was when George Reeves came in, and he was so compelling that despite the limitations in his acting skills, he became stereotyped as Superman to the point where, in later years, one morning I woke up, and I presume you woke up, Mindy, one morning to this outrageous headline that Superman had killed himself,
right.
which was not only inconceivable, it seemed physically impossible, but we had so come to love and adore George Reeves that he, to me, when I close my eyes and think of Superman, it is still George Reeves that I see.
So do you think the circumstances around his death, did that have an impact on the brand of Superman?
It had an impact to the point where they thought about ending any TV shows ever because it was so shocking. And then they thought about bringing Jimmy Olsen, a guy named Jack Larson, back to have his own series. And they ended up keeping Superman off the TV show until decades later when he came back in the form of Superboy and then the Lois and Clark TV show. Mm-hmm. But it took decades for America to get over that.
We're talking with Larry Tighe. His book is Superman, the High-Flying History of America's Most Endearing Hero. In the mid to late 1940s, Superman was also showing up in cartoons at the movie house. And then Superman serials. There were short films that played before the main attraction. Superman was becoming big business. Did the character of Superman change because he became a moneymaker?
They were smart enough to realize the changes were okay, but only to a point. That this was the goose that was laying a very golden egg for them, and they weren't about to change the essence of who Superman was. And whenever they tried, whenever they tinkered a bit too much to go to the cartoons, to go to radio or TV, fans let them know, and they brought him back to the central figure of who he was, which I think is the key to why he's lasted 75 years.
So while Superman was growing in popularity with the kids, there was a faction that blamed comic books for corrupting youth. Just like, you know, music is something's always corrupting you. Seems kind of ridiculous now when we think about it. But later generations have also cited violence on television and the movies, video games, as I mentioned, music. So how did this backlash against comic books impact Superman?
So it was what we called the great comic book scare that happened at the same time. At the same time, Joe McCarthy was helping fuel this Red Scare in America. People were looking for a reason why juvenile delinquency seemed to be soaring in the country. And this is a time of West Side Story, and the story was being played out in lots of popular culture in America. And the easiest target to blame were the often very violent comic books of that era. And it was one thing to go after sort of the gore and the really lowest life comic books. But the idea when they started taking on Superman, they had gone one step too far. And Superman outlasted the scare. Mm. And even though they toned it down and Lois became a little less curvaceous, and there was never any sex in Superman,
right,
and there was not a whole lot of violence because Superman didn't believe in killing his enemies. But even what there was got toned down a little, but he outlasted every force for 75 years to try to do him in.
Yeah. Let's talk about the TV series when it started. Robert Maxwell was at the head, and then it changed with Whitney Ellsworth when he took over. Went from being sort of dark and violent to, as you said, where Superman wasn't quite so violent.
Right. So Robert Maxwell was a really outrageous guy, and he liked to do interesting and outrageous things when he controlled Superman on the radio and on TV. And he had him, for instance, go after the Ku Klux Klan in an era when most of America was not willing to take on the Klan. And he actually broadcast on the airwaves and made fun of the Klan and its secret passwords and all of its rituals. And this helped, according to an authority no less important than the great Grand Dragon. He said that one of the biggest enemies that he ever had to face was Superman, with a generation of kids being taught certain lessons via the radio and the TV show. And when Whit Ellsworth came in and took over, they were worried, Kellogg's was worried, who was the big sponsor back then, that maybe Superman was getting a little too edgy. Mm. And so very few episodes that had much in the way of violence, very few political episodes after that, and it became toned down. And we went from a Lois Lane, who was a much sort of feistier, edgier Lois Lane, to the one who became famous and synonymous with the show, who was Noelle Neal, who played Lois Lane for all but 1 year on TV.
Mm. Now, before we had special effects, we used the phrase trick photography to explain how impossible things like flying superheroes was done on TV and in the movies. Describe how Superman flew in the early days of television.
Yes. Well, I got to start out by saying it was trick photography, and it didn't work very well. And the way he flew was he jumped on a trampoline out a window, and then they had him held up in the air, George Reeves held up in the air by a crane, and they had fans going and sort of wind blowing by him to make it look like he was flying. And I think, again, it was a sign of just how much kids were willing to suspend belief, because I don't know anybody who watched the show and thought that he was flying. But that was all the TV could give us then, and that was all we needed for our great hero, Superman.
So except for reruns of Superman on television, Superman disappeared from the screen until, we mentioned, 1978, when Superman the movie came out, starring Christopher Reeve. Mm. This is sort of a surprising thing people may not know. It was made by a filmmaker who had never heard of Superman until his son suggested it as a next project. How did someone without this knowledge of American pop culture make a film about an American icon?
So these were producers who bought from Warner Brothers the rights to produce the Superman movies. Warner Brothers thought there was no future in Superman films. And they sell to these two strange characters named Alex and Elia Salkind the rights to Superman. And Alex Salkind, a Holocaust survivor who may have been the only person on the planet who had no clue who Superman was, decided that this was a hero and he understood heroes and he had survived the Holocaust and he knew that countries like America needed a hero to believe in. And so they went out and hired a director who got how to do these things, a guy named Richard Donner. And they hired an actor who was trained at Juilliard and thought that he was going to be a great sort of stage presence and never imagined doing movies and never imagined doing Superman. And this was a kid named Christopher Reeve. And he was good enough that he lasted for 4 movies. Mm-hmm. And kids who grew up in that era, the same way I close my eyes and I see George Reeves, kids who grew up in the 1970s close their eyes and imagine Superman as Christopher Reeve. He looked the part. He did a great job of distinguishing Clark from Superman to the point of slumping his shoulders and really taking on a very different physical feel when he became Clark, and it worked brilliantly.
Of course, and then we got Margot Kidder as Lois Lane.
She was extraordinary.
she was kind of a feistier Lois Lane, I guess.
She was feisty enough that she made it clear that when they replaced Richard Donner as director that she didn't like it, and her time in every successive movie started ratcheting down to the point of not being in the last ones.
Talk a little bit about that controversy with Richard Donner.
Sure, the controversy was that Richard Donner was a very independent guy, and he didn't get along with the Salkins, and he wanted to do things the way he wanted to, which was spend money and make this movie as true to life as he had grown up. Donner had grown up with Superman as his hero, and he had plastered on his wall one word, which is, and I'm going to mispronounce it, verisimilitude, which basically means stay true to who the character is. And that was what he intended Superman was going to do. The screenplay originally had been written by the famous Godfather writer Mario Puzo, and it had lots of quiche in it. And Donner basically threw that out and said, we are going to have Superman be a real hero that every kid can still grow up adoring. And he did that. And that movie has become cult-like to the point where today you can go to a video store and rent not just Superman the movie, but Superman the movie, the Richard Donner cut, with everything thrown back in it.
That's interesting. We're talking with Larry Tye. His book is Superman, the High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. Superman's movies 2, 3, and 4 followed in the late 1980s and really brought Superman back into the mainstream of American culture. Then Superman returns to TV, as you mentioned, with Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman in the early 1990s. And then we had Smallville that premiered just after 9/11 and ran for nearly 10 years. Talk about Superman's portrayed in those two TV series and how they were different from the previous descriptions of our superhero.
So both were coming around at a time when Marvel Comics was overtaking DC, and with the idea of having characters who were more real life and more angst-ridden was sort of the notion of what would succeed. So it was not accidental that in that first series it was not called Clark and Lois or Superman. It was trying to be two real characters, and Lois was by far the more interesting, I think, of the two characters. And this was Terry Hatcher, who went on to great fame in TV and elsewhere. It was, again, trying to bring Superman down to life. So you very seldom saw him in his Superman uniform. He was Clark working at the newspaper and doing lots of things outside of a Superman guise. Even more so in the series that kids of today's era would recognize, the Smallville series. It lasted, I think it was 9 seasons. It worked in part because the original producers of it said, no flights, no tights. And what that meant was keeping him out of uniform, trying to understand who Clark Kent was as a kid growing up with puberty and with all the angst that kids face today, and trying to make him real to life. And yet kids would sit down and watch it with their parents, and their parents would say, but this is my Superman, isn't it? And where is he?
Yeah.
And it was really interesting. Kids almost didn't recognize that this was a series at the beginning about Superman.
And we haven't talked about Lex Luthor at all. And he's changed, of course, over the course of this as well.
He was the great mad scientist who started out in his pre-Lex form as a character, a villain named the Ultra-Humanite. And the thing that stayed constant was trying to invent somebody who was a human being, but who was evil enough that he used his scientific prowess to do Superman in. And various backstories became common over the years, that he and Clark had grown up together in Smallville, and that they had had some bad accident at his lab, and he had gone from being Clark's buddy to being his antagonist. And it was part of this whole tradition of Superman. You start out with the grain of a story, and then over the years you can expand it to the point where you've got a backstory and an entire legion of characters, all of whom have a real history that you can either come into as a newbie and still find them compelling, or if you're an old fan, you can recite every one of the backstories there is.
See, as an actor, I think that would be the most fun part to play.
It really would
be. As we mentioned earlier, the co-creators of Superman, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, had sold the rights to Superman, but throughout the decades, they continued to have involvement in the different iterations of Superman and even sued to get more money. Both have since died, but how did they or their families eventually get more compensation for their creation?
So what happened was they sell it for $130, and that's the bad news. The good news was they were making salaries back in the early 1940s that in today's terms would amount to hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. And they were actually taken pretty good care of, and they became national celebrities. But over the years, they perpetually felt like they had been robbed, and they would sue and they would lose. And DC Comics would say to them, if you come back and promise never to sue again, we'll take you back. And they would do it, but then they couldn't resist 5 or 10 years later in suing. What has happened is today there is, in the 1970s, when Warner Brothers came out with the great Christopher Reeve's movies, they decided that having Jerry and Joe on board with this made a whole lot of sense. And they started giving them annual payments that took care of them, that took care of their families, and took care of their medical bills. Mm. Yet in the late 1990s, in the early 2000s, before they died, they again started feeling like they were owed more and their heirs were owed more. And there is a lawsuit that is still pending today with the heirs of Jerry and Joe. The only question is how many tens of millions of dollars they will settle for. They've won the first phase of the lawsuit. And to me, the question also is, the lawsuit has divided up the various pieces of Superman. And they said Jerry and Joe created, when they first came to DC, things like the cape, the tights, and the underpants worn on the outside, and those belong to the heirs. Things like the ability to fly didn't come until later when they were clear employees of DC. And so they're pulling apart the character. And what I think we need today is a judge with the wisdom of Solomon who realizes if you rip the baby in half, there's nothing left.
Right. So Superman's set to return to the big screen next year. Man of Steel is currently in production. Do you have any thoughts on how Superman of 2013 might be portrayed?
I think it's going to be portrayed in a very, very careful way. It's partly that it's being produced by Christopher Nolan, who gave us the great Dark Knight Batman movies. And it's also that in this days of the internet, when they came up with a 30-second clip that they showed in this summer's Batman movies of the new Man of Steel movie, they were flooded with hundreds of thousands of emails based on a 30-second clip that they might be destroying the character. If they tinker with it, they will lose, and if they don't, they'll make more money than the $1 billion Batman made this summer.
Yeah, Superman continues to be the number one superhero. And DC versus Marvel?
DC versus Marvel, I think that you can have your angst-ridden Spider-Man characters, to me, give me a tried-and-true, unflinching Superman that stands, that knows the difference between right and wrong and always has, and I think that will still be what America wants.
Larry Tighe, his book is Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. Thanks, Larry, for coming in, and good luck with the book. We're going to go out with some of John Williams' Superman, the movie music, and we'll have a link to Larry's website at our website, capeandislands.org. Just click on the point. Thanks, Larry.
Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
And we have an update on that lawsuit over the Superman copyrights. A federal judge has ruled that Joe Shuster's heirs have no right to reclaim those copyrights. The ruling means that DC Comics and its owner, Warner Brothers, will retain all rights to use the Man of Steel in books, films, TV, and other media. Judge Otis Wright noted that the heirs of artist Joe Shuster agreed in 1992 to annual payments from DC Comics in exchange for all interest in Superman.